The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hi, I'm Allison Herrera. You might remember me from the previous episode of In Trust. I helped Rachel report some of the stories we told you about in this series. I'm also the Indigenous Affairs correspondent for KOSU, a public radio station in Oklahoma. Since In Trust came out, I've been hearing from a lot of people who say that what happened to the Osage wasn't isolated. I've heard from citizens of other tribal nations all over Oklahoma with their own stories, their own land with big mineral deposits, their own ancestors who were victims of exploitation or died suspicious deaths. And I thought it was important for you to hear some of those stories too. So I'm taking the lead on two bonus episodes. The first about a reservation not too far from the Osage Nation. That's today on In Trust.
Okay, we are in Pitcher, Oklahoma, and it is basically, I mean, if you can just picture mountains or sand dunes, very large sand dunes, just a little bit different color, that's what it looks like. And this large one behind us, it looks like a small mountain.
That's Martha Barker, a Quapaw citizen from Miami, Oklahoma. She was the first Miss Indian USA, and with that title, she helped raise money and awareness for Native causes. Whenever she can, she draws attention to what happened to her family and their land on the Quapaw Reservation. That's why I went out to visit her on that land in Pitcher, Oklahoma, in the northeastern part of the state, about 100 miles east of Osage County. And that mountain she's describing?
It's the tailings from them running the ore and stuff that they mine out of the ground. They run it through these big crushers to get the lead and the zinc out of it. And then this is the leftovers.
More than a century ago, a massive amount of lead and zinc was discovered in this area. And those minerals were extremely valuable. A lot of the bullets fired in World War I and World War II came from here. But that mining brought environmental destruction and toxic pollution, too. Now Pitcher and the surrounding towns are effectively abandoned.
It looks like a moonscape. It was on the list of the number one Superfund sites in the United States, and it's lead contamination. You know, in the water, soil, everywhere.
A Superfund site is a place with so much hazardous pollution that the government has to come in to oversee the cleanup. This one's called the Tar Creek Superfund site. You may be familiar with this area from news reports talking about a ghost town. One headline read, "Take a tour of America's most toxic town." This Superfund site is sprawling, covering Pitcher, nearby Cardin, and Quapaw land near the Kansas border, about 40 square miles. Mining companies dug so much here that sinkholes dot the landscape, and some parts are blocked off with wire fences to keep people from going near there. But what often gets lost in all the stories about Pitcher is whose land this is, Quapaw land, and what happened to those Quapaw families whose land held some of the greatest mineral wealth America's ever seen.
When you drive into Pitcher, everything on the left-hand side of the main drag and going all the way to Cardin is basically my family's cousins, families, uncles, aunts, and stuff. It's all of our allotments. But, you know, the lead and zinc is still down there. And it bubbles up in the streams and the and wells and creeks and everything. When it rains, the water is orange and it foams.
I've been there and seen it. There's lead and zinc still in all those piles. After it rains, streams look slick, like oil has been spilled. Around Tar Creek, plants and the trunks of trees are orange.
I have no idea what we can do with the land, but it's what we've inherited. Mm-hmm. So we've inherited a big mess, you know.
I want to back up here to say something about the Quapaw and how they ended up in Oklahoma. Like a lot of tribes, they were forcibly removed from their ancestral homelands. In the 1830s, the U.S. government forced them from Arkansas and Mississippi to what's now Oklahoma. Before long, allotment came. That was the U.S. policy to take communally owned land from tribal nations and divide it up and sell what was left to white settlers. Knowing that allotment was coming, whether they wanted it or not, the Quapaw decided to do it themselves. Martha said that process was corrupt.
There was a gentleman that came from New York City. He was Mohawk Indian, and he ingratiated himself into the tribe and kind of took over control of our council and befriended the BIA and took it upon himself to allot the land. He added in his children, his wife, his in-laws, anybody that would pay him $200, he would add him into the tribe.
The BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, rejected the list several times. But Martha says the man befriended bureaucrats there, too.
And so he allotted the land, all the good quality land, farming land, to his families and to the families that bought into the tribe. There's probably about eight of us, eight big families that couldn't speak English. We were given the land that was poor soil conditions, couldn't grow anything on. My grandmother tells stories about how when they first moved there, they couldn't drink the water. That's where the lead and zinc mines were discovered.
A lot of the mining on Martha's land was overseen by the U.S. government, like it did Osage Mineral Wealth, as a trustee. Quapaw families say it wasn't managed well, and that a lot of times it was mismanaged. The Quapaw's mineral rights belonged to whoever owned the land. So that wealth, it wasn't evenly distributed. Some Quapaw citizens hardly got anything. Martha's family allotments had a lot of lead and zinc under them. One rich deposit was on the land of her great-great-grandmother, named Anna Slagle. Martha told me a story that was similar to those I'd heard in Osage County. Anna, at one point, was married to a Quapaw man, and when he died, she inherited his wealth. What happened after Anna inherited it? Martha says it was suspicious.
She owned several homes down here along the Spring River area, and just kind of went back and forth between them. She went to the BIA to get a chauffeur because they had to approve everything.
You have to remember that a lot of Quapaw families couldn't spend any of their money without permission from the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
She came back with this homeless man. He was non-Indian. He was a white man. And he's like 30 years younger than her. She's an old lady. He's like a young, young man. They wound up being married. And she was killed by him. I don't know how else to say it any other nice way. He drove, she was asleep in the back seat of the car, and it was a big touring car, and he drove her off a cliff, and he got out, he survived. She did not, and he inherited her money and her land. Luckily, she did have a will drawn up, so some of her children did get some of that land and money.
Do you have the death certificate?
I do not, but I have an article in a newspaper that tells the story about it. How she was...
Any investigation?
No. Why? No. No. Are you kidding me? No. No, because he was a white man and she was full-blood Indian.
The article Martha mentions from November of 1934 says Anna Slagle was 70 when she died and had interests in seven mining leases. And according to Martha, some of Anna's wealth went to her driver and some of it to her children. But even the land her family did hold on to, it's not in great shape.
I'm sure this land was probably, you know, somewhat pretty before the mines went in. But now it's just forgotten. It's forgotten, just like a lot of the tribes are forgotten. A lot of the people are forgotten.
So how did the mining go as far as to turn a once pristine prairie into such a toxic wasteland? And if this was one of the biggest mining operations in the country, where did all the money go? It turns out there's a guy in town who knows the history of the mining industry better than anyone.
When you grow up in a small town like Pitcher, that's really all you know. There may be a town next to it, but really all you know is a small town.
This is Ed Kahili. Even though Pitcher is on the Quapaw Reservation, a lot of non-Native families moved here in the early to mid-1900s to work in the mines. Ed's family was one of them. That's next.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
I was born in Flippin, Arkansas. My father was a sharecropper in Flippin, and in 1943, he heard that there was work in Pitcher, Oklahoma, in the mine. My mother packed everything we had in a suitcase and cardboard boxes, and we caught the train to Joplin, Missouri, and somehow we made it from Joplin to wonderful Pitcher. And so I lived in Pitcher until I was a sophomore in high school.
Ed Kahili is like a walking encyclopedia. He has boxes and boxes of old receipts, maps, photographs. This all started as a retirement project. Before he moved back to Oklahoma, he lived in California, where he was a nuclear engineer for the government at the height of the Cold War. But Ed says, even with all the projects he had going on back in California, he couldn't stop thinking about Pitcher.
I had always kept ties with the area back here, maintained friendships, and made a couple of trips a year.
So in the 90s, Ed and his wife packed up their things and headed back to Oklahoma.
We live about 9 miles east of here along the Spring River, and we built a home out there, raised cattle. I wanted to be nearby, but I did not want to live in Pitcher. You know, there's not a lot of lawns and, parks and that sort of thing.
Ed's been researching, digging deep into the history of the mining industry. Ed's father worked for the biggest mining company in Pitcher, called Eagle Pitcher. At first, I assumed the company was named after the town. It wasn't until I started talking to Ed that I realized the town was actually named after the company.
And so they began to expand in 1914, and they needed a town because this was open prairie for miles, and they needed employees, so they needed people. Eagle Pitcher built a first church in town, and they built a few homes for some of their internal staff, and they built the first water tower, and they did everything they could do to support the town, including providing law enforcement. In a wild and crazy town.
By the 1920s, 11,000 miners were living in and around Pitcher. This was all happening on Quapaw allotments, mining companies releasing and sometimes buying land outright from Quapaw families. And remember, this was a time when thousands of Native Americans were deemed incompetent to handle their own affairs. So those leases and deeds, they were going through the BIA.
They began to drill in downtown Pitcher here, just two blocks over from here, and discovered the mother lode of the entire Pitcher mining field was beneath the city of Pitcher.
Ed says the BIA and the mining company would negotiate leases with the verbal agreement from the Quapaw landowner.
And then the Bureau of Indian Affairs then was supposed to collect that money from the mining companies, and then pay that to the Indian owner.
Ed's looked at thousands of these leases, and what he found was that the U.S. government wasn't collecting the money they should have been for Quapaw landowners. Millions of dollars, he says, should have ended up with Quapaw allottees that mining companies kept for themselves. But it wasn't just the mining companies that were getting rich off of the Quapaw land. As Ed was digging through all these documents at the Ottawa County Courthouse, he started to notice something else. That there were way more leases than there needed to be.
There was a Ponzi scheme that lasted for the lifetime of the mining field.
What Ed found was that Quapaw landowners would enter into an agreement to get a royalty rate for their land, say 5% of the proceeds. But whoever got that lease, they could release the land to someone else at a higher rate. And then someone may package that lease up with others and lease it to the mining company for even more. Basically, middlemen, layers of investors and companies in between the Quapaw allottee and the mine operator, taking their cut. But this scheme, it not only cheated the Quapaw landowners, it also ate into the profits of the mining companies themselves. And slowly, smaller companies started going bankrupt or selling to the big players like Eagle Pitcher. Eventually, only a couple of companies had control of all the mining here. And those companies, they got more and more desperate to extract as many minerals as they could. They went back to old mines and dug some more, closer to the surface, and even dug into what they call pillars, the places that miners leave underground to keep the surface from collapsing. In the 1960s, there were three bad collapses in one neighborhood. Those residents moved, but the ground kept collapsing, and the toxic piles kept growing. Those giant piles, they're called chat. While Ed and I were talking, he offered to take us to the top of one to see what it looks like today.
We are on top of one of the last tailing piles in the Pitcher mining field in downtown Pitcher. This particular pile is about 107 feet high and about a quarter mile in diameter. And from here, we can get a panoramic view of the old mining field, and you can see a large number of tailings, mill tailings that are still in existence, 360 degrees from here, to give you some sense of the extent of the mining.
It was a clear and cold day. Up on the pile, you can see Kansas to the north, Missouri to the east, with chat piles stretching for miles between, like giant sand dunes. There was a beat-up plastic sled at the top of the chat pile. A lot of people who grew up here remember sledding down these chat piles or shooting bottle rockets.
See those buildings down there? Those are in the worst zone. And the old Reunion Park, where we used to have the annual reunion, is severely undermined. It was the worst area that we found in all of the areas that we studied.
Ed was hired in the early 2000s to examine the risk of cave-ins, back when a lot of people were still living in and around Pitcher. His job was to figure out which parts of Pitcher were most likely to collapse. We've read the report he submitted to the Army Corps of Engineers. The risk of cave-ins was so bad that one of their recommendations was to reroute school buses so kids weren't at risk of the ground collapsing from beneath them on their way to school. And there was lead in the soil and the water, which is a serious health risk because it can cause nerve and brain damage. At one point, the Indian Health Service took blood samples from kids around here and found elevated lead levels in 35% of the children they tested. Eventually, the cave-ins and the lead pollution were so bad, the state and the federal government came in to buy people out of their homes. That was about 15 years ago. Most families didn't want to leave their community. A few refused. The buyout process was fraught with all sorts of allegations of corruption, all the way up to the federal government. Ed said he spent a lot of time back then trying to advocate for local families. He was frustrated they weren't being given enough money to move. Ed wanted us to see one of those cave-ins up close.
This particular area, this is the third time this has collapsed. It has been filled and collapsed three times. So that, you know, you can stand here and you can look in all directions and it looks like a pristine prairie. And then all of a sudden you get something like this and you say, no, wait a minute, is this land really safe?
The hole was deep, maybe 50 or 60 feet. There was another a few hundred yards away.
Anybody want to go closer and look in?
Yeah. Are we gonna fall in?
I don't know. This is a small collapse, yes. This is about 60, 70 feet across. As I mentioned, we logged 104 that were over 100 feet across.
As we drove around, we saw trash around the base of some chat piles. Beer bottles, children's toys, the skeleton of an old hotel. It was mid-afternoon. If this was any ordinary town, school would be letting out. People heading home from work. But this is Pitcher. It's quiet. Eerie.
Okay, we're going to hop out here real quick.
There was one other thing Ed wanted us to see. He took us to another place. Here, the ground was uneven. Ed says he has a personal connection to this spot.
Okay, now, let me explain to you. During the buyout, they were trying to figure out where do we put all of the debris from these homes we're destroying. They came up with this bright idea that instead of taking all of that material to a sanitary landfill and paying for it, why don't we just put it in a hole in one of the big cave-ins and, you know, mark it complete. And along with everything went in here is my old childhood home is in here. So I have a private stake in this place.
During the buyout, remnants of his home and the homes of others were put in a sinkhole. According to Ed, this land is going to collapse again with all the stuff that's wet and decomposing. At one point, the mining company, Eagle Pitcher, was on the hook for almost $2 million for cleanup. But it filed for bankruptcy and ended up paying a lot less. Now, it's owned by a private equity firm in Chicago. We contacted the firm, GTCR, but they declined to comment. We asked Ed why he spent so much time on all this. Why not just leave his childhood home in the hole and move on?
Everything we've messed up, we have an obligation to fix. And, you know, and it's that simple. It is so easy to mess things up. You know, we've proven that time and time and time again. But it's a whole different thing to try to fix it.
Fixing Pitcher, fixing the Quapaw Reservation won't come cheap or easy. But the Quapaw Nation is working on that, on the ground and in the courts. And Martha Barker and other Quapaw citizens are doing their own reclamation. Those chat piles we've been talking about, they're more than just hills of rubble. They actually have value today. It's all raw material for making roads, lots of roads. That's next.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Different asphalt comes in different, the chunks come in different sizes, and this is a very, very sought-after size.
That's Martha Barker again. She took us out to her family's land to show us one of the big chat piles. Right as we were standing there, talking about the value of the piles, a truck drove up next to us. Martha waved it down.
Hi, Martha Barker. Okay, so are you with the tribe or the remediation?
The guy told Martha he was with an asphalt company.
How freaking weird was that, running into an asphalt guy? Right, you know, that's the way it is. It's like when my mom, when she came down one time.
I couldn't help notice Martha's suspicions of this man. That's because there's a long history here between asphalt companies and landowners. And Martha's mom, she was right in the middle of it. Her name was Ardina Rivard Moore. She lived in Miami, a town about 15 minutes south of Pitcher, where she taught Quapaw language classes.
She would drive back and forth. And she kept noticing when she'd drive by pictures that the chat piles were going down and down and down. And so she drove out there and she noticed there's just dump load trucks lined up 16 deep, just hauling off the chat.
When Martha's mom saw all those trucks hauling off chat from her land, it made her wonder how much money she was getting for it.
Her IIM account hadn't changed in years.
An IIM, an individual Indian money account, holds the money the government manages for Native Americans. If companies were taking chat off her land, it should be showing up there.
No income was coming in, but obviously they were hauling chat off. So she called her cousin. They went out the next day and they had a little pocket Instamatic camera and they started taking pictures of these big, huge trucks hauling off all this chat. And she took her pictures, armed with her pictures, went to the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Miami, and they told her, do not make trouble for this office. Yeah, well, that just lit her fire.
Those pictures she took, they gave her the proof she needed. Chat being sold from her land wasn't being paid for. So in the early to mid-2000s, Quapaw citizens filed two lawsuits related to the sales of chat. Both allege that their trustee, the federal government, wasn't keeping track of all the sales and accused them of mismanagement. The one filed by Martha's mom, Ardina, and other plaintiffs was over piles that disappeared in recent years. A second case was over piles that disappeared decades earlier. The U.S. has actually agreed to settle both lawsuits, though without admitting it did anything wrong. We reached out to the BIA, and they said they're working to protect the trust assets of all Native Americans and Alaska Natives. They said that includes helping people who own mineral rights achieve economic self-sufficiency through developing their resources. After the U.S. settled those cases, one of them paid out. That's the one Martha's mom brought. But the other one needs an act of Congress before the government can release the money.
It has been stuck in committee for the last year and a half. Will not make its way out.
This is Guy Barker. He's the former secretary treasurer for the Quapaw Nation, and he's an attorney who worked on both lawsuits. He's also Martha's son.
It is a true responsibility, you know, the same way as you and I have to pay for our electric bill or, you know, make your house payment. This is a debt owed by the federal government, and they continue to sit on it.
The payout they're waiting on, it's $140 million to the Quapaw families involved in the settlement.
So there's a possibility that, and given the environment that we're looking at right now, with extraordinary expenses and quite a lot of debate over government spending, they could make a decision not to make good on their promise. And that's something that kind of continues to terrify some individuals that have worked on this for so long.
That money is important, enough for Quapaw families to pay bills, cover expenses, maybe help send their kids to college. But Guy says it doesn't even come close to the amount of wealth that was extracted from Quapaw land.
And so to imagine that amount of money that could have gone to a community, it's hard to wrap your head around and to see what good kind of really could have come from it is impossible. But I know, having grown up around that area, we're very far from that in terms of reality. The unbelievable majority of our tribal members live under the poverty line. And to see where that has kind of happened, and purely from a responsibility standpoint, it's frustrating.
I asked Guy what he sees when he pictures the Quapaw Reservation in the future. He says, just look at the part of the reservation that wasn't mined.
There's a huge piece of fresh water and a river that runs right through the center of the reservation. And there's an area where mining practices were never conducted, right? And you drive through there and it's heavily wooded, it's very green, it's extraordinarily lush, it's beautiful, very hilly, you know, picturesque, all over the place.
The Quapaw Nation is currently working with the EPA to clean up the polluted land. Guy says it will take a long time, but in the end, it'll be worth the work.
And so hopefully in 30, 40 years, we can kind of see a completely remediated area. It's going to be a long process. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to watch it unfold kind of as the decades come, but it's certainly not going to happen overnight.
We've been telling you the story of the Quapaw and the fight for their land. It's just one of the many stories I've heard about the taking of land, the taking of wealth. That part of Indigenous history is rarely taught in classrooms. And for decades, Native stories have been written out of the narrative in popular culture, obscured by a shinier version of Oklahoma and the West, one that reduces Native people to relics or caricatures and places settlers in a more heroic light, or doesn't include Native people at all. One of the most known stories is a musical set in Oklahoma with singing cowboys and dancing farmers, a big song about statehood, and a bright golden haze on the meadow. Except that's not the whole story. That's on the next bonus episode of In Trust. About the show, go to Bloomberg.com/Intrust. Intrust is a production of Bloomberg and iHeartMedia.
This episode was reported and hosted by me, Allison Herrera.
Additional reporting by Rachel Adams Hurd. Victor Ibeas is our senior producer. Jeff Grocott is our senior editor. Sage Bauman is our executive producer and head of podcasts. Additional support from Katie Boyce, Gilda DeCarli, and Kathleen Quillian. Sound engineering by Blake Maples. Our fact-checking was done by Molly Nugent. Theme music by Laura Ortman. Photography by Shane Brown. You can email us at podcasts@bloomberg.net. Find In Trust anywhere you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.